Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We hear so much about the death and pain brought on by opioid addiction, but according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, excessive drinking takes more lives than opioids. It accounts for the majority of all addiction treatment cases and is responsible for at least $250 billion per year in lost productivity and costs related to crime, incarceration, and health care. More than 88,000 Americans die each year as a result of excessive drinking, according to the CDC. And research by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism finds deaths from boozing and binging have more than doubled in the past two decades, with sharp increases in the rates for women and the middle-aged. What's going on? And what does this look like here in Kentucky? For some answers, we've invited to Eastern Standard Tara McGuire, the Alcohol Prevention Enhancement Specialist for the state's prevention system. Thanks for joining us, Tara.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thank you so much for bringing me in and drawing attention to this really important topic.
Well, you bet. And to begin with, quoting George Koob, he's the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism that I referred to in the introduction, he says, quote, alcohol-related deaths involving injuries, overdoses, and chronic diseases are increasing across a wide swath of the population. In fact, these deaths have more than doubled since 1999. What are you seeing here in Kentucky? Is it this bad here? Worse?
Yeah, so in Kentucky, a couple of things that I really wanted to kind of talk about. One is the alcohol-related overdose deaths, and this is according to the CDC's Wonder System. So in 2018, there were 150 overdose deaths that occurred where alcohol was listed on the death certificate as the primary cause or one of the substances involved in the overdose. But now looking at some of the gender differences, in 2018, male overdose deaths, those were actually 2.5 times higher than the female overdose deaths. So the male rates are already higher. But now what I did, similar to what the study actually did with the NIAAA, is I went back over the last couple decades, and I really wanted to take a look at some of those statistics. So again, still looking at those alcohol overdose deaths within our state. Males were higher than females by about 2.5 times in 2018. However, between 2000 and 2018, so almost two decades, they both increased at about exactly the same very high rate of change. And that rate was in excess of 300%. So in 2018, for example, it was 150 deaths, but the rate of increase was actually 333% over the last two decades. So there's a lot of stuff occurring with the overdoses. Another thing I took a look at, because I do a whole lot of work with underage kids and how that they're getting alcohol and if they're getting it, are they drinking it and how they're drinking it. And the thing about kids that many adults don't perhaps maybe realize is that whenever youth drink, though they drink less frequently than adults generally, when they do drink, they tend to drink a lot at one time. So binge drinking, a lot at one time, 4 to 5 drinks on the same occasion, or sometimes even more. And what I discovered with the Kentucky underage rates actually was that there isn't a whole lot of difference between the rate of change between the females and the males going back over those last couple decades. However, I did find that the Kentucky female youth alcohol rates are actually lower than the males, and good news, they have generally been decreasing for some time. So despite that these are encouraging numbers, it is important to remember that alcohol, as you said, remains the most widely abused substance for Kentucky youth in most grade levels.
If on the national level, the rate of increase among women is soaring, we seem to be kind of bucking that trend here in Kentucky?
We do, actually, based on what I was able to find. Now, that said, I don't have access to all of the statistics that really all the different data points and things that were really reviewed within this study. So what I did is I took a look at two main data points. So I took a look at the youth across a couple of different surveys, both the Kentucky Incidents for Prevention, the KIPP survey, which is done by Reach of Louisville, and also the Youth Risk Behavioral Survey, YRBS, which is done through the Kentucky Department of Public Health and the CDC in cooperation. So those three main data points, looking at youth, looking at overdose deaths, I did not see a significant difference in the rate of change to suggest that in Kentucky, the rate of even female alcohol consumption or even the related harms is increasing at a faster rate than it is for males.
Do you know from what you've found in your research if the alcohol overdose deaths are concentrated among younger people who binge drink? Is that where it's happening mostly?
So I did actually try to take a look at some of the different age ranges within those overdose deaths. And I do know that they do range across a variety of age ranges, but the numbers actually were so small that they were suppressed within the CDC's data system.
Back to that institute study that I mentioned in the beginning, women are at greater risk for cardiovascular diseases, certain cancers, alcohol-related liver disease, and acute liver failure from excessive drinking. Why is the risk greater for women?
Women actually do, on average, have a lower body mass than men. There's some hormone differences going on, and there's also differences between the ratio of body fat to muscle and the water concentration within our bodies. And all of that does mean that a female, on average, so not in every case, but on average, will become intoxicated at a faster rate drinking the same amount of alcohol as a male. It's for that reason that the NIAAA and numerous other national institutions does define the rate of binge drinking, which is a lot of alcohol at one time, as four or more drinks on one occasion for females and five or more drinks on one occasion for males.
What trends here in Kentucky are you keeping an eye on with concern?
So some of the trends that I've really kind of taken a look at is going to be really that underage drinking rate that's occurring within Kentucky. As I said, alcohol is the highest or the most consumed, most abused substance by Kentucky youth in the 8th, 10th, and 12th grade levels. So tobacco comes in a little bit higher for the 6th grade level across those grades that are surveyed. Though our rates have been decreasing and our rates are below the national average, Kentucky still has a very high rate of youth that report having a high degree of access to alcohol. The accessibility for 10th graders, according to that KIPP survey by Reach of Louisville done here in Kentucky, 10th graders, one in two of them in Kentucky said that they actually have a very high rate of access to alcohol if they wanted to get a hold of it, versus about one in six reported that they're actually drinking it. And numerous did report, one in eight, I believe, reported actually drunkenness within the last 30 days as a result of their drinking. So again, while they might not be drinking as often as adults, when they drink to high-risk levels oftentimes, and that's a serious concern. Another thing, you mentioned the chronic diseases. Kentuckians overall experience a high burden of chronic diseases compared to the nation. The percent of Kentucky adults participating in high-risk drinking, so heavy drinking and binge drinking, and reporting potentially chronic diseases is on the rise. So some of those diseases are going to be things like diabetes, coronary heart disease. They could also be things like stroke and other things going on within that. So the overdose, like I said, seeing that 333% increase, I believe that that was the female rate and the overall was 355% over the last couple decades, so 2000 to 2018, for the alcohol-related overdoses, that's a pretty extreme statistic really to take a look at and is something that we are monitoring. And also impaired driving is another one. You know, Kentucky, as many other states, has made a lot of progress, whole lot of progress. I actually started my work with Mothers Against Drunk Driving with MAD back in the early 2000s, but going all the way back to the 80s. You know, MAD and numerous other groups really campaigned. You know, if you're going to consume alcohol when you're out, get a responsible driver to take you home. Exercise responsibility when you're out there. Don't drive impaired, meaning don't drive with any amount of alcohol in your system, because we don't know what other kind of factors might be going on. Sleep, other substances present, distractions, all sorts of things. But still, impaired driving does remain an issue in Kentucky. In 2017, according to the Kentucky State Police, on average in Kentucky, every 1.75 hours, so almost every 2 hours, an alcohol-related crash occurred. One fatality occurred due to drunk driving every 2 days. And the really shocking thing to me, the really powerful thing, the disturbing thing, is that 5 teen drivers were involved in alcohol-related crashes every week in our state.
Every week?
Yes.
Why do you suppose, Tara, that we as a society often voice alarm, concern about drug addiction? I'm separating that from alcohol addiction. We do this loudly and frequently, but we seem to kind of look the other way when it comes to alcohol. What's going on there?
Well, I think that, you know, we do. We hear so much about the opioid crisis. We hear so much about fentanyl. We hear so much about even marijuana and cannabis and numerous other substances. Vaping, a major trend going on with teens that, you know, that our state fortunately is trying to take action against. But we do hear an awful lot about those things. But it is important to really go back to really what the scientific literature has been saying for decades, and that is alcohol is considered a gateway substance. The way that alcohol impacts the developing teen brain, national studies have revealed that 95% of alcoholics over the age of 21 report that they actually began drinking before age 21 and took their first drink. So 95%. There's another study out there dating back all the way to the mid-90s, but it's one that we reference oftentimes in my prevention field. It talked about how that if a youth takes their first real drink beyond just a few sips before age 15, they're actually about 4 to 5 times more likely to develop a problem with alcohol later in life over the age of 21. So, you know, when we talk about alcohol as a potential gateway drug, that means that we're trying to prevent alcohol use at an early age because we're trying to prevent addiction, not just to alcohol, but potentially addiction or a predisposed behavior to other potentially illicit substances that might negatively impact a person's life later on. So it's not just about the youth. It really is about prevention and about what we're trying to do in an overall sense. And as I said, and you said as well, you know, alcohol does have a strong correlation to numerous chronic diseases that we're finding here in Kentucky. In fact, according to the CDC's report, 10 top chronic diseases within 2016 that they said that our state really should be taking a look at, it found that 5 of those had a relation to excessive alcohol consumption. And while I mentioned that the youth rates of alcohol use, of access, of binge drinking, and even of drunkenness are all decreasing in our state, between 2015 and 2017, so most recent data available for adults, there's actually another study done by the Kentucky Department of Behavioral Health and the CDC in our state and many others. And in Kentucky, they actually discovered that the rates of binge drinking and chronic alcohol use have actually increased during that time for adults.
Well, Tara, given the work that you do, which has prevention at its core, what is your message? What do you want people to know or to understand about alcohol?
The big thing that I want them to know about alcohol, that alcohol, just like any other drug, we can prevent the harms from it, the excessive alcohol consumption, the underage youth. And, you know, Kentucky prevention, it works. Prevention is cost effective. The sooner that we address these problems, the more money and resources are saved and the better the outcomes. Prevention specialists are working along with myself in 14 regional prevention centers across the state with thousands of community members and concerned citizens. So these are going to be people like educators, faith-based leaders, small business owners, youth, and many other concerned people. So to provide the best environments and the healthiest communities. And again, I'm just grateful for you and for this radio station for taking the opportunity to meet with me and really to call attention to this very important topic impacting our state.
Well, we thank you so much for taking the time. Tara McGuire, the Alcohol Prevention Enhancement Specialist for the state's prevention system. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Tara McGuire, the state alcohol prevention specialist, mentioned some of the health consequences of heavy drinking. With a grant from the Centers for Disease Control, Apple Shop is producing a series of reports to encourage lifestyle changes that can slow or prevent one of them, type 2 diabetes. Parker Hobson has more from Whitesburg.
Every other week, a small group comes together at the Breathitt County Extension Office in Jackson, Kentucky, to learn and share and joke and tell stories and support each other in regards to their health. But they're not sick, and they don't necessarily have any symptoms of anything. They're trying to prevent type 2 diabetes.
So when you all eat, what do you usually eat first?
Whatever looks the best.
Yeah.
See, I was thinking. I wonder. Yeah. I save my favorite for last, so I probably eat more like the vegetables first. But sometimes that's bad because if I'm full,
then you don't get your favorite.
I'll eat it anyway.
That's what I was thinking. I would eat it anyway.
I'm not about to die.
The group is meeting through Juniper Health as a part of the Diabetes Prevention Program, a lifestyle change program developed by the National Centers for Disease Control. Juniper is just one of several clinics and health departments that offer the program across the region, and all of the groups are full of local people trying to stop diabetes before it starts.
You hear all the time people in the clinics talking about so-and-so lost a toe, or their aunt or uncle lost part of their leg, or, you know, we have a lady who's lost part of her arm. You know, it's just ridiculous when it's preventable.
Bridget Turner of Juniper Health is one of the facilitators of the Diabetes Prevention Program, or DPP for short. A few years ago, she herself was diagnosed with diabetes.
I was frustrated. There were so many opportunities along the way where I could have been given more information that I wasn't. It was really just disheartening to think, now I have it. And I didn't have to have it. And that's probably why when Missy said, let's become educators, I said, okay.
So, especially if you live around here, you've probably heard of diabetes. But briefly, there are two kinds. Type 1 diabetes is genetic, so you have to be born with it. Type 2, though, happens over the course of your life, and very basically, it's when your body stops being able to get rid of glucose, or sugar, in your bloodstream. This can lead to serious problems. It can damage your eyesight and your kidneys. It can cause you to lose feeling in parts of your body, and eventually even lose limbs. And it also carries a huge risk for cardiovascular disease, which in some cases can be life-threatening. But even if all this is familiar, there is another condition known as prediabetes that you might not know about. Basically, prediabetes means you don't have type 2 diabetes yet, but your blood sugar is high enough that you're officially in the danger zone for getting it. Prediabetes is often diagnosed through what's known as an A1C test, which takes an average of your blood sugar levels over the past 3 months.
If your blood sugar is, 5.7 to 6.4, you are pre-diabetic. And if you don't do some things to make some health changes, the chances of you actually developing diabetes are pretty high. And once you get diabetes, once you get over the 6.4 mark, you have diabetes forever. It doesn't go away. It might be controlled, but according to what we understand from my medical knowledge, once you get it, you've gotten it.
Part of what makes prediabetes so tricky is that you can have it without showing any symptoms. According to the CDC, about 1 out of 3 Americans already has prediabetes, whether we know it or not. Jonathan Piercy is a doctor from Hazard, who works in the diabetes clinic at Perry County's North Fork Valley Community Health Center.
It would probably be easier if high blood sugar hurt, if there were a whole lot of symptoms, but in order to have actual symptoms acutely of high blood sugar, then it's got to be very high, which is part of why it takes so long for somebody to get treated.
Sadly, Eastern Kentucky has higher rates of diabetes than the rest of the state and the country. But even though it's common here, health workers say there are misconceptions about it. For one, they say people don't always realize that diabetes is preventable, even if it runs in your family. Rebecca Smith is another DPP educator at Juniper Health.
I actually had somebody pretty well known in the community tell me, he said, got that diabetes, I knew it was coming. It finally got me. I
was just like, come and got him, huh?
Come and got him, right off the couch.
I think it's just become commonplace for people. Grandpa had diabetes, granny had it, my aunt, sister had it, my aunt had it, and everybody just kind of is like, okay, I have diabetes now.
Mary Beth Castle is the DPP educator at the Johnson County Health Department in Paintsville. She herself was diagnosed with prediabetes a few years ago.
Okay, maybe I am going to end up with type 2 diabetes later on in life. I mean, it's the possibilities for me are good, but I'm willing to take the chances to try to prolong all of that down the road as long as I can.
And the DPP is set up to help people, especially people with prediabetes, prolong or even prevent diabetes entirely. It varies a little by county, but it's a year-long program. You meet in a small group once a week for 16 weeks, and then about once a month after that. Everyone gets an individual weight loss goal, and then you focus on strategies for getting there, like healthy recipes, keeping a log of what you eat, or tricks to get more exercise over the course of the day. Bridget says losing as little as 5-7% of your weight can go a long way in preventing diabetes.
We know that increasing activity and making better food choices can help prevent diabetes. What we have found is people who come in gung-ho for the program and have a lot of weight loss up front tend to burn out. Because they go so hard and so fast, it's not something that they can sustain for a lifetime. We talk a lot about baby steps. If you drink a lot of sugary beverages, where's maybe one less beverage that you could drink? Can you get up on a TV commercial and walk to the bathroom and come back? We want you to start thinking about ways that you can be more active. And 5-7%, if you weigh 300 pounds, 5% of that's only 15 pounds, right? So that's doable.
Another misconception the DPP tackles is that it's only sweet foods that can lead to diabetes. Here's Dr. Piercy again.
This is a point that a lot of people miss, is we're not just talking about things that are sweet. We're talking about breads, talking about potatoes, talking about starchy things. That's probably where more people get in trouble. It's the same molecules, the same glucose that gets formed when those break down.
You know, and just understanding, reading the label. And if you're eating a low-fat yogurt and you think you're doing great, but then you compare a low-fat yogurt with a light yogurt and realize the low-fat yogurt has twice the carbs in it as the light does, then you realize, oh my goodness, I thought I was doing good. Well, you were doing good. You just didn't have all the information. So here's a little bit more information.
Once you realize how much turns into glucose, whether it's ice cream or bread or potatoes, it can be overwhelming. But it doesn't mean you have to stop eating everything you like. Here's Mary Beth again.
I don't tell them they can't eat this or they can't eat that. I tell them they can have what they want to eat. They need to do it in moderation, and they need to look at portion sizes. We live in an area where our grannies and our mamas want our plates to be full of food, and they want us to eat everything on there. Trying to get them to get back to that, instead of 3 spoonfuls, start with 2 of green beans instead of 3 of the green beans, even though that's probably a better thing that you can eat. Because if they just cut back on portions alone, that's going to make a difference. I don't expect them to come in here and have 10 pounds lost, you know, in a week. Or maybe not even 10 pounds in a month. If they're moving the scale in the downward direction, that's what we want them to do. And I want them to feel good about it.
Kathy, on the other hand, did have a blog for me.
She's good.
So good.
She gets bonus points for the day.
Look at that one cup of water.
I'm trapped, Kathy.
Yoo-hoo.
Well, I was probably in denial, but my parents and my family have it. And life had happened to me. I lost both parents within 7 months. I was a caretaker, so I didn't get out a lot.
LaDonna Arms is from Paintsville and has been a member of the DPP group at the Johnson County Health Department. Mary Beth has been her group leader.
I guess it was just dealing with everything with my parents, and then when I lost them, I'm thinking, you know what? I'm not getting any younger. It is really time for me to get it in gear, you know, get it under control. I started making gradual changes. Started walking a lot. Like Saturday, I walked over 7 miles. And I may want a candy bar, but then I may look at that calorie and that sugar content, and I'll think, I don't need that. So I may take a piece of fruit. And I was a big pop person. It's unbelievable amounts of sugar. Tried the sugar-free cherry Kool-Aid, you know, drink a lot more water. Just make better choices. Mm-hmm. And I feel a lot better.
You care to share how much weight you have lost?
As of today, 23 pounds. This has been life-changing for me.
Aww.
And I couldn't have handpicked any better group.
Had I thought about being diabetic? No, not really. I didn't have it in my family. I didn't have any symptoms. But I also know that I don't want any.
Doris Newton lives in Jackson, Kentucky. She recently went through the Juniper DPP program in Breathitt County.
I think accountability, that's probably the biggest thing that got me where I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And because we did it together and the other class members, and we were always very verbal about, did you lose any? Mm-hmm. Oh, if you didn't, it'll be all right next week. And I was pretty successful. I think I did lose the most in that class, 23 pounds.
It was nice to not have to suck it up to zip your pants.
Masha Ott lives in the community of Wolverine. She was in the same class as Doris.
But I just followed exactly their protocol, and it really, really works in terms of knocking the pounds off. I think it was 17, if I count right. Diabetes is something you can turn around. Nip it in the bud, you can change it.
And a program like this can help you make those changes.
None of this is to say the DPP is easy, though. For one, changing habits is always hard. But healthier food can take more time to prepare and is often more expensive, which can be tough if you're on a budget. And in many parts of the region, places to buy groceries at all can be few and far between. Many local communities also just don't have very many practical or affordable places to exercise. The participants I spoke with, though, said these challenges were real, but the key for them was doing it together.
The weekly meeting is wonders. And just getting to hear what everybody else is doing. You know, if they've had a rough week, if they've had a great week, you know, just that moral support.
We have talked a lot about pop.
That's the biggest thing.
How's it going, Kathy, for you with drinking pop?
I'm not drinking her.
Are you drinking her?
But are you
okay.
Are you enjoying it?
Yes.
Well, there you go. But you're targeting other areas.
Yes.
I have not met anybody who wants to make choices to lead them to diabetes on purpose. You know, and even myself. Am I as healthy as I need to be? No. But I don't drink pop anymore, you know. And my A1C is in a good place. I will not do things that are going to contribute to me not being able to see my grandchildren. My father-in-law lost his vision. And my last baby, he didn't get to see. That was preventable. And my brother-in-law died from diabetic complications. That was preventable. It doesn't have to happen.
And I'm looking for a life change. I don't want this just to be for 3 or 4 more months and then stop. I want it to be for a lifetime.
In Eastern Kentucky, the Diabetes Prevention Program is currently offered in small groups at the Kentucky River District Health Department, Juniper Health, the Clover Fork Clinic, the Johnson County and Clay County Health Departments, and online. To get your A1C checked, it's a simple blood test that your doctor can do in a single visit. For more on all this, and for a short quiz to see if you might be at risk for prediabetes, check out doihaveprediabetes.org. For Eastern Standard, I'm Parker Hobson from Apple Shops WMMT in Whitesburg.
This coming Tuesday, March 24th, is National Diabetes Alert Day, a one-day wake-up call that focuses on the seriousness of diabetes and the importance of understanding your risk. Coming up after the break, a new chapter in our series on the 19th Amendment. Jackie Jay interviews Center College Associate Professor of History, Sarah Egge, author of Woman Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest.
It was risky to fight for women's suffrage, or really any sort of women's rights cause, in part because these ideas at the time were really radical.
And trading cards featuring influential women, the work of Transy senior Shauna Morton.
I got this idea because I was learning about all these women who were really cool and did great things in history, but I wondered why I was learning about them when I was like 20 years old in college.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Eastern Standard is hosting a year-long monthly series looking at the 19th Amendment, 100 years after its ratification, establishing the right of American women to vote. EKU history professor Jackie Jay has this month's interview.
I'm here today with Sarah Egge, associate professor of history at Center College. She's written a book titled Woman Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest. And today we'll be talking about the specific experience of women's fight for the right to vote in the Midwest. I'll start by asking you to define for us the geographic area of the Midwest. What states do you include in that term, and what brought you to that particular area of research in the first place?
Well, I'm glad to be here. And so there's lots of debate about what states are included in the Midwest. Some people think that it's kind of maybe Iowa is the middle. Some people move it a little closer to Illinois or even Ohio. But generally, it's kind of in the middle or the interior part of the United States. And it does include states like Ohio, all the way over to the Dakotas and then south. And this is where it gets a little bit fuzzy. Maybe Nebraska, maybe even Kansas. Some people put Missouri in there. But again, if you kind of just section off the center part of or the interior part of the United States, that's where we think of the Midwest. The reason I chose the Midwest is because I'm from the Midwest. And I took a class in college on women's history. And when we learned about the women's suffrage movement, I thought that this was fascinating. But then I realized that so much of the research was on either women in the Northeast or maybe women in the West, but there was very little about women in the Midwest. And I had more than a hunch, I would say. I had some lived experience that told me that Midwestern women were fierce advocates of women's rights. And I wanted to know more about women's suffrage in this particular region. And so that's where it really began.
And as your research developed, how did ordinary activist women agitate for the right to vote, and what was significant about their actions and their advocacy?
Well, the first thing we need to know is that it was risky to fight for women's suffrage, or really any sort of women's rights cause, in part because these ideas at the time were really radical. And so one of the things that women had above all was their reputations. So anytime they sought to go out and agitate for a particular radical cause or controversial cause, they put those reputations on the line. And so what they had to do then, and what I find so fascinating, is they often banded together and they used existing collective or voluntary associations of women to sort of make a shield for themselves to preserve those reputations. So the organizations that in the Midwest in particular were most in line for women's suffrage were the temperance advocate group, so the Women's Christian Temperance Union, or the WCTU. Federated women's clubs were also very popular at this time in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and they were also often aligned with women's suffrage. But then also lots of church organizations, ladies' aid societies were very popular among Midwestern women, mission societies. And so these were already venerated organizations of women. And these were the places where they could then bring forward women's suffrage. And so you see things like, we want the right to vote so that we can squash the rum power, which is really a pro-temperance or prohibition sentiment. But in fact, that's where that idea came from, is that it's better for us to preserve our reputations if we can band together collectively and come at women's suffrage from sort of a web of activisms already in place.
And what you've said, that women are essentially navigating their gender and social roles at that point, that in certain ways they're working within the expected norm, but in other ways they're pushing back against that. And so could you delve a little more deeply into how people at that time are viewing women's roles and that intersection of religion as religious organizations come into play and how gender roles come into play?
Yes. So Midwesterners are very church-centered at this time and still remain one of the—it's the region with the largest number of churchgoers. And so religious ideas, in particular about gender, were very important for a lot of Midwesterners. And what they believed is that women ought to do as the Bible says, basically serve, obey, be silent, and support in this sort of patriarchal family unit where the husband or the father is at the head. And so this is the system then where there are independent men and then there are dependents, which include wives and daughters, children broadly. And so this then sense of the family unit is really profound, and it's encapsulated in this biblical Christian teaching. And so that gives you a sense of just how much of a big deal this was to talk about women being independent voters or having their own mind and making their own political decisions. When you start to talk about those things, you aren't just talking about a political change. You're talking about a change in the very fabric of the God-ordained family. And people took this seriously in the Midwest. And so I think we forget that sometimes, just how radical these ideas were. But if you think about this in terms of some of these cherished beliefs, it really underscores just how devastating it could be for women if they struck out on their own and started to advocate for women's suffrage. That's why it makes sense then that they would collectively organize to sort of have that power or superiority in numbers.
And it sounds as though other issues like temperance were key issues that then gave women that window to open and to convince the rest of society that this was an acceptable thing for women to then have the vote because they could be instrumental in bringing about those kinds of changes. Was that the predominant argument that women had for gaining the vote? And was that something that was largely accepted by the men in their families and in society more generally? Or was that something that took a long time for them to gain acceptance?
Well, it's definitely the latter. It does take a longer time. And I like to break it up. So the late 19th century is really where we see women starting to navigate the message that they're going to send. And they often strike this message that you've indicated, where this is really women at their moral guidance, where they are able to sort of steer the family away from the perils of drunkenness, for example, or the monster of intemperance. And they're able to do so, again, as women in their cherished roles of the family. But then they start to attach the vote, and they say that the vote will also enable us to better protect the home from these vices and corruptions. And this in the Midwest does work. But what also is interesting, by the early 20th century, what had been a period of settlement, white settlement in particular, women had really taken advantage of that opportunity to act as public servants in ways that they could not do in other regions. We are literally building communities, and women are often raising the money to construct the first churches and libraries and schools and public buildings. And so they accrue this civic responsibility. They say that we are responsible not only only are we morally good, but we also understand responsible citizenship. So by the 20th century, they enhanced that moral argument of home protection and cleaning up politics by saying that we understand it as good citizens, and good citizens or loyal citizens then ought to have the right to vote. And so the emphasis is not so much on it as a right of individual citizens. It's more on this idea that the vote shows responsibility. And it's a shift when we think about what are these things like voting. Is it a right? Is it a responsibility or a duty? And so we really start to think about citizenship in more profound ways.
And one thing that I have discovered as a result of this series is just how fragmented the experience is across the United States, and that different locales, the traditions of different locales play a huge role. And race is also a very important factor in terms of determining who is allowed to vote and what the rationality for that is. In the Midwest in particular, how does race and ethnicity and immigration and background play a role in the women's suffrage movement?
Yeah, so that's the final ingredient to this story. So you have these white American-born women. They often are middle class, educated, and they often come from the Northeast. And so if you read in my book, I call them Yankees, which when I say that in Kentucky, I think people think of Civil War. Some of these people were Civil War veterans, and they often fought for the Union, but not all of them. Really, Yankees just denotes where they're from, and it's really more of the Northeast. And they come to the region in the 19th century ready to build these communities and settlements. They realize, though, that they need other laborers and workers alongside them to do this work, because they feel like they're really building this from scratch. And so immigrants pour into the Midwest as well at this time, and mostly from Europe, primarily from Northern and Western Europe. The number one immigrant group are Germans, and then they're followed by Scandinavians, so Norwegians and Swedish people and Danish and et cetera. And so these people come, and they are excited to settle there to also take advantage of this economic opportunity, just as these Yankees were. But they settle sort of in an unsettled way, as I say. The immigrants often settle in rural enclaves, and they can avoid assimilating. They send their students to parochial schools that they created, not public schools, which means they can continue to speak their native languages. And so this issue of immigration starts to bubble to the surface over time. And by the 20th century, it becomes a bigger issue, especially as we start to approach World War I, where the United States will increasingly see itself positioned against Germany and Germans. The other big issue that the Midwest has, more profoundly than other regions do, is that in most Midwestern states, these immigrants could vote before they became citizens. And it's one of these inconsistencies of rights, in particular voting and citizenship. They basically could get the right to vote after 2 years of living in the United States when they declared their intention to get citizenship, rather than the full 5-year period of actually residing in the United States and then becoming actual citizens with a certificate. So this produces a conundrum unlike any other region, where you have actual citizens, women, who cannot vote, working alongside, living alongside people who are not citizens, but who can vote. And increasingly, as we get closer to World War I, this question is really about loyalty. How can you trust these Germans who can vote, who've never actually pledged their loyalty because they've never actually undergone that full naturalization process? And that's increasingly what these suffragists will say. They will use these nativist arguments to make their case that women then, white women in particular, should have the right to vote.
And so the suffrage movement in the Midwest is predominantly coming out of that quote-unquote Yankee population, not the immigrant German Scandinavian population. I would imagine that those women are not the ones who are fighting for the right to vote.
Right. Not primarily, right? Most of them are Yankees. There are some. So Minnesota does have the Scandinavian Woman Suffrage Association, although during World War I, they do kind of have to backtrack their activities a little bit. And there certainly are individual examples of some women who were predominant, who were of ethnic, maybe they were Norwegian or German, but there's few. Most of them are Yankees. And it really does see this sort of ethnic divide as the place where women's suffrage plays out in this region.
Really interesting. And what specific examples from the Midwest can you give us that showcase how the movement worked particularly there?
So one of the campaigns I really think illustrate this is the 1918 campaign in South Dakota. South Dakota had 7 amendment campaigns, which is by far the state with one of the largest number of these campaigns. And it's a state that's overlooked in part because national leaders like Susan B. Anthony, Carrie Chapman Catt, they didn't like South Dakota because it had all these immigrants and they kept losing and they kept blaming immigrants for these losses. So by 1917, when the bill was initially proposed, everything seemed like it was going to be the same old campaign where if they won, it would be a feat of strength for them. But what happens is that in the spring of 1917, the United States declares itself on the side of the Allies fighting against Germans. And for the suffragists, this is a key moment. Then the governor of South Dakota adds a clause to what was the normal woman's suffrage amendment. So in addition to enfranchising women, it also disenfranchised anyone who was voting on a declaration of intention, that system that we've talked about. And so what it actually does is it changes the entire meaning of the amendment. People no longer call it the Woman's Suffrage Amendment. They call it the Citizenship Amendment. And the propaganda completely changes. In previous campaigns, women suffragists would say, women are equal or women are going to protect the home, these kinds of messages that they had heard up until this point. Now they're saying, you should support the Citizenship Amendment because you are 100% American, right? We don't want any slackers, is what they say. And really what that means is you might be considered a German enemy, and they do actually say they think that these German enemies are going to sabotage the United States through the ballot box. So they're really pivoting away from this idea that this is just about women to a broader question about who should vote. And their answer is whoever is loyal.
And that ties in beautifully with what Josh Lynn said last month and the fact that this fight for women's rights and for the vote for women really then comes into issues of exclusion, and that just because some people have the right to vote doesn't mean everybody has the right to vote, and there's that negotiating element.
Right.
And so, as you see from the ratification 100 years later, do you see any of those trends that are present in the Midwest in the time that you're researching? Are these things that you continue to see resonate in current events today?
Oh, yes. So I think this helps us tell harder stories than we might often want to tell. I think sometimes we want to look at movements and we want to say that these women sacrificed and they worked so diligently. And in the end, they convinced people that women ought to be equal. And that's not necessarily the case. They did that work, it's true, but they also worked to exclude people. And I think it resonates with us to consider how we even now build partnerships and coalitions and messages. And it makes us think about who are we including in those messages and who are we excluding for our own purposes. I think a lot about the kinds of activism that we see. And I think this story gives us some pause to really reconsider what kind of goal we have in mind and if that goal is actually going to do the things it's going to do. The reality in this case is that women's suffrage was not an inclusive movement. It was not for all women. And it also, in the process of gaining women the right to vote, excluded people who did have access to rights, these non-citizen voters. They lost a right. And we can talk about the reasons why and what we might think about non-citizen voting rights today. But it, I think, again, helps us see with more complexity how these coalitions and messages might not always be doing the things we think that they're doing.
Thank you so much.
EKU Professor of History Jackie Jay with Sarah Eggie, author of Woman's Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest, this month's guest in our series on women's suffrage. Shauna Morton is paying close attention to the status of women in the 21st century. Shauna is a senior religion major at Transylvania University. She's from Charlotte, Michigan. She plays Barry Sachs in the Transy Jazz Band, bassoon in the Transy Orchestra. And Shauna plans to pursue a career in public relations after graduation. And a project that ties in with our series on the 19th Amendment is what brings her to Eastern Standard. Welcome, Shauna.
Thank you.
So tell us about this project.
Yeah, so I got this idea last year, and then I applied for the Keenan Grant through Transylvania University. And I got this idea because I was learning about all these women who were really cool and did great things in history, but I wondered why I was learning about them when I was like 20 years old in college. So I decided to make trading cards of these women and have like an image on the front and information on the back. And then I gave these trading cards to students at Cardinal Valley Elementary so they could learn something about women at a younger age.
And so are you thinking of having them printed up and distributed?
Yeah, they're actually already printed up. I sold some to Transy staff and students, and they're also like blown up in the art gallery that they're in right now, like 8x10 posters of the trading cards, which are smaller.
And so why is it important to you to recognize influential women?
I just think it's important as a woman to see other women doing great things, because especially at a younger age, because sometimes you just don't see the representation there. And I have great role models in like my immediate family, but beyond that, I didn't know about all these amazing women that can be really great role models and can be inspiring to younger women.
And Shauna, you're about to graduate. You're about to go out into the world and put that inspiration to work, actually. So what are your thoughts about feminism in this year, 2020?
I obviously think feminism is very important. I don't think that the word feminism captures every women's movement that there is. It's kind of a term that can be exclusive in some ways to the Western feminist idea. But I obviously do think rights for women are important and doing things as women is important.
How does your focus on religion in your studies at Transy figure into your plans to work in public relations?
Well, I know that in a lot of international businesses, they just don't know when they're dealing with other international companies how to be 100% respectful of people's religious beliefs. And I think my background can help me approach situations like that while being able to be inclusive and just think of things that other people might not have a background in when they're dealing with public relations.
Okay, and back to your trading cards. How can our listeners learn more about them? Where can they see them?
Right. So when the Cardinal Valley students got the cards, they each made a art project inspired by someone that they learned about, and all of that artwork and my posters are hung up in the gallery in the Kentucky Theater this month, so people can go check them out there.
Shauna Morton is a senior religion major at Transylvania University in Lexington. Thanks for coming in, Shauna.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
A couple of notes before we go. You can learn more about the coronavirus, COVID-19, including facts about the virus, as well as national and international updates, online at weku.org. You'll see the red box over on the right. Click on that. And very excited here to announce a new feature coming soon on Eastern Standard, Kentucky Songcrafters, hosted by singer-songwriter Carla Gover. Interviews with the songwriters of Kentucky by one who knows how it all works. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.